Welcome to Octum History, a weekly podcast produced by the Berlin Tour Guide and presented by myself, Simon J. James. This week, episode 3 of Murder on the Tracks, The Chase. It was the 16th of July, and out on the sea the weather was more than fair. London, on the other hand, was gripped by a cloud of sensationalism that had enveloped its people over the murder of Thomas Briggs on the 9:50 from French Church Street station. Over the investigation, a mist lay. Little had come to light other than a mysteriously shadowy figure who traded a chain, once belonging to the murdered, with the brother's death. Jewelers on the Cheapside, but had promptly rejoined the dark and disappeared in a city of millions, only his accent lingering. But at sea, everything was quite different. It was so different that he had decided to sit and write. Write to those that he had just left as he embarked upon his great adventure, following in the footsteps of many of his fellow countrymen, and countrymen from many nations, both wealthy and impoverished, who dreamed of a new life in the nation that lay beyond the great Atlantic Ocean. The sun shone down on the wooden vessel that he departed from London on the Friday morning, Friday the 15th of July. Clear blue skies had welcomed the ship when it had set sail from the North Quay of the London docks shortly after 6:30 in the morning. The Western Dock numbered 20 acres of water, for boats from across the British Empire laden with people, goods, packages and drinks to be loaded or dispatched for all corners of the globe. The rectangular dock was surrounded by large brick warehouses, 5 across the North Quay, 1 long building divided into 6 on the west, the south similar. The east was known as the Wine Quay, but predominantly the buildings, which were more than sizable, dwarfing their neighbours, housed the tobacco from the New World that was filling the clay pipes of every London man, from the dock worker to the financial trader of Lombard Street. But to see these buildings with a clear view was nigh near impossible, as the tall masts of the sailing ships, the clippers, the schooners, barks and brigs, their webs of ropes rising high amongst their stored sails, obscured the view. The Victoria was one of those ships. She was a grand ship, not spectacular, but streamlined to the movement of the waves through which she sailed. Sealed with tar against the elements, her hull was a deep black, bar a ribbon of white that drew around the mid-waist, where the few openings lay within her side. 3 masts perforated the sky, each hung, when at full sail, with 3 sails. The masts topped with flags, the British red duster ensign, the American stars and stripes, the nation to which she sailed to and belonged to, and the red swallow tail flag, a symbol of the Grinnell owners and their packet line to the American East Coast, which she sailed. The Grinnell Company was one of the leading companies of its day to sail the packet routes to America. They had grown international fame 13 years prior, in 1851, when the clipper Flying Cloud had sailed from New York to San Francisco in 89 days and 21 hours, beating the average journey time for the 16,000 nautical miles to San Francisco by 110 days. The company had begun by running ships from Liverpool to New York in 1822 under the Blue Swallowtail line, and a year later they entered the market that sailed from London to New York under the name Red Swallowtail line. To their rostrum of ships that sailed the Red Line, the Grinnell Company had the Columbia, the Sir Robert Peel, after the Home Secretary and Prime Minister, who gave his name to the Metropolitan Police Force members as Peelers or Bobbies, the Prince Albert, Yorktown, London and Rhine, amongst many others. It had been on the Wednesday that he had approached James Gifford and his colleague, Jacob Weist, of German origin, who had relocated to London to work as an agent for the Grinnell Company. The man, tall, slicked back, hair that was going somewhat wiry, had entered in a dark suit, gold chain fastened to his waist, coat pocket, and a golden ring upon his finger, and asked for passage to America. "How much?" the man had asked. "To America?" James Gifford asked in response, Vice noting the man's accent, and that they were both of German origin, but choosing not to interject and speak in their mother tongue, rather allowing Gifford to continue in English. £4 for a packet ship? That would be £450 in 2020. "And how long will it take?" the mysterious man asked. "3 weeks," Gifford responded.
"That long?"
"It's a packet ship, not a passenger ship. It has to stop on multiple occasions to take on and let off mail."
"Fine. When does it sail?"
"Tomorrow," replied Gifford. The gentleman left, but it was not long before he returned. He returned with the £4 required as the fee for the ticket. "Name for the ticket?" Gifford asked of the man. "Pardon?" the man said in retort. Gifford looked toward him with a grimace of annoyance. "I need," he began, "a name. After all, it is a contracted ticket. I must put your name upon it. It is company policy."
"Müller," the man replied.
"Christian and surname, please."
"Franz Müller."
"Perfect. Thank you, Herr Müller." Gifford spoke with a tilt of the head. Franz Müller left once again, only to return once more at 3:30 in the afternoon. This time, when he entered the agency office of Mr. Gifford, he carried with him a handful of packages. Gifford was used to passengers carrying parcels with them, especially the poor Germans who, not wishing to miss out on their pork rations, carried bacon, sausages, and such wrapped in parcels for the voyage. Franz Müller entered with 3 packages, the largest of which was 18 inches long and 9 wide, the others much smaller. The large packet was wrapped in canvas. Gifford could not note what was inside, nor did he think to, but as far as he could tell, there was no sharp objects within, and none protruding. "Would you mind awfully," Franz Müller spoke, "taking charge of this package until I sail?"
"I'm afraid, sir, Herr Müller, I cannot. I am but the agent of the sale of tickets. Packages are handled by the foreman. If you proceed outside, you should note where he is, under the shed. That is where you will be able to leave your packages." Franz Müller left for the 3rd and final time from Mr. Gifford's agency. On Friday, not the morrow as Mr. Gifford had said, but the day after the morrow, that Mr. Gifford saw Franz Müller boarding the Victoria. Now Franz Müller sat on board the rather cramped quarters of the Victoria, the parcel ship that could carry a cargo numbering 1,000 tons and sailed around the southerly coast of England. The ship had departed the North Quay on the Friday morning at just after 6:30. Sailed through the Wapping Basin and turned into the Thames. Those on board, along with Franz, were people who could not afford to make a return journey. They were hoping for a new start in the new world, not knowing what truly lay across the water. Many illiterate could not read the papers to know the torrid civil war that was destroying the country. They did know there was the option to buy land and become landowners, even with the chance to own estates larger than those to which they had been in servitude to in their home countries. So in leaving, they took the opportunity to stand on the deck and look back towards the city of London as they beat a retreat from the great Norman fortress of the Tower of London that had once controlled entry to the city. The Victoria sailed along the wide body of the river whose banks in the summer heat were far from the water's edge. They sailed past the new pumping station at Crossness that functional exterior hid its wondrous interior. Soon the villages that were on the cusp of being swallowed by the great sprawl of a city gave way to countryside. Trees drank in the waters that filtered down to the river, dense forests of green seemingly unspoiled by man. Where the trees gave way, fields were golden with the summer crop of corn baking in the high heat. One could be forgiven, quite quickly, for forgetting the city with haste. That is, until they turned around and saw the towers of black, acrid smoke rising from the chimney stacks. Much time passed, and the day was quickly advancing as the sails, controlled by the boatswain, remained predominantly brailed. shorn up to the beams, besides a few that pulled the ship forth at a gentle speed in the busy shipping channel. Eventually the Thames widened more and the Victoria passed through its mouth and set sail for the English Channel. England would not fade from view, however. The Victoria was to follow its coast, occasionally porting to collect parcels bound for America and goods to be traded. Franz Müller was 24 years old, a native of Saxe-Weimar-Eisenach, the nation of German classicism that had played host to Schiller, Goethe, Herder, and more, who had bettered the world with their literary turns of phrase and inspired new love and become muses to the arts. Franz Müller had been living in London, however, for the last 2 years until he set sail on the Victoria. Arriving in London in 1862, he had belonged to the respected guild of weaponsmithing. Becoming a gunsmith in his native land, a professional journey that had absorbed much of his life and brought him plenty of skills. However, upon his arrival and on finding accommodation within London, he had found it more than difficult to find a job within his trained profession. Maybe it was the fact that Britain didn't quite have the number of nobles that the German-speaking lands had, or perhaps it was that they didn't have the taste for dueling that was still common on the continent. But there was not the need. He found his disdain for someone of his talents. So he had turned to become a tailor, using his steady hands to cut cloth rather than steel. He had first taken work with a tailor by the name of Hodgkinson and remained in his employ until the 2nd of July. It was then that he had decided that he was going to start anew in New York. And now he sat at his desk beneath the deck of the boat and wrote a letter.
On the sea, July 16th, in the morning. Dear friends, I am glad to confess that I cannot have a better time as I have. For the sun shines nice and the wind blows fair, as it is at present moment, everything will go well. I cannot write any more, only I have no postage. You'll be so kind as to take this letter in.
He closed the letter, sealed it within an envelope, and then upon the front wrote an address, Blythe, 16 Park Terrace, Old Ford Road, and placed it in the mail sack that was to be unloaded at Worthing. George and Enid Blythe were in the kitchen at their residence at 16 Park Terrace, Old Ford Road. Inspector Tanner, whom Sir Richard Mayne had appointed as chief investigator to the case of the murder of Mr. Briggs, was also present along with the cab driver, Jonathan Matthews. It was Matthews who, in knowing Franz Müller, had connected the dots. He had found in his home a box from the jeweller's death, which Müller had given to Matthews' daughter. It was this that had triggered his action earlier on the 19th of July, 1864, to report his suspicions to the police. At the Hermitage police station at Paddington, Matthews had stood before Sergeant Steers, before the two had raced to Matthews' home, retrieved the jeweller's box and proceeded to 4 Whitehall, collected Inspector Tanner, and now they all stood at the home of the Blythes. George Blythe worked as a messenger, and Enid stayed at home to look after the family. To supplement George's income, they had allowed for lodgers to stay for a small fee per week. Those who chose to stay would receive a basic bedroom and 2 meals a day, a breakfast and a supper. The food was the same as the family ate themselves. It wasn't extravagant or lavish, but enough to fill a belly to the point that hunger was staved off, if it was just for a short while. Enid was still in a shock as to the manner in which the strange man, Tanner, who had arrived within her kitchen so much without even a cursory knock, had been demanding to know of her past tenant. "Where is Müller?" the inspector had demanded to know, to which she had replied, "On a steamship to America." Which was partly true. He was on a ship, but it was under sail rather than under steam, on its way to the New World. "When did he leave?" Tanner asked impatiently. On the 14th, I should think," Mrs. Blythe answered. Tanner grew with annoyance. It was at that moment it felt as if the rope to which the whole investigation was tied to had slipped from his grasp, and the crushing weight of public opinion was going to come crashing down upon him. Wrestling with his frustrations, Tanner managed to bring himself under control, and if it was indeed true that Franz Müller had already sailed for America, then it was best to gather as much information now as he could, for there seemed little chance of chasing after the man now presumed to be the murderer of Thomas Briggs. So he turned his attention to Enid Blythe. How long has Mother been staying with you, Mrs. Blythe? Oh, I should say several weeks, I should think by now. And he left on the 14th? He did indeed, sir. Can you tell me anything about his day, what he did, who he spoke to? Sure, I can tell you what I know, no harm in that. He lived on the first floor. I can show it to you later if you wish. Tanner nodded. First floor, at the back, I should say. Didn't get the road frontage. He took his meals with us. I knew he was a tailor. He usually left our house at 7:30 in the morning, or from that till 8. Was he often home late? Tanner inquired. No, not late. You are aware of the murder of Thomas Briggs on the North London Railway, are you, Mrs. Blythe? That I certainly am. Most of London is aware of it. Terrible. Then perhaps, Mrs. Blythe, you might be able to enlighten us to the movements of Mother around that weekend of the 9th of July. I'll tell you what I remember. I can do that. I remember the morning of Saturday, 9th July. I saw that Mr. Muller at 11 o'clock in the morning. When he went out, I did not expect him home at any particular time at night. I sat up till 11 o'clock that night. He had not even come home. He had a latch key. I did not hear him come home. My husband, George, and myself went to bed at 11 o'clock, you see. I saw Mr. Muller the next morning. He was home then. I saw him between 8 and 9 o'clock, I think it was, that I first saw him. He breakfasted with us and stopped at home, or at least was with us the whole day. On Sunday, he would take every meal with us. I considered him to be of a kind and human disposition. We would walk sometimes on Sunday together, and we did that day. How was he on the Sunday, Mrs. Blythe? He exhibited the same manner as he always exhibited. He was lame in the left foot. I think it was the left foot. I cannot be sure if I'm honest to you. But I think he was lame on the Saturday. He had a slipper only on one foot on the Saturday. In the evening, the Sunday, my husband, myself and Mr. Muller, we all went out together and returned together. That was the Sunday evening. He spent the whole day with us on Sunday. On the Monday, I saw him between the hours of 7 and 8. He breakfasted with us. Then it must have been around 8 as usual that he left. He came home 12 hours later. That'd be 8 in the evening? Tanner asked to reconfirm. Yes, Inspector. 12 hours after 8 is 8. Mrs. Blythe replied cynically. He spent some time with us, he did that evening. I remember he sat with us and showed us a new golden chain he had. I hadn't seen it before. It was an Albert chain, I think. It certainly was gold, but he said nothing of it, just showed it to us. He told us he was going to America sometime around then. When did he leave? Tanner asked. He was here the Tuesday and the Wednesday then. Thursday morning, that is. He came with a hat box and a long black box. Actually, I think I still have the hat box. I think he left it. Would you mind collecting it, Mrs. Blythe? Not at all, Inspector. Mrs. Blythe exited the room for a few minutes and Tanner took the time to look to steer. Their eyes met and both could see that the other was excited that they might just have the man who had killed Mr. Briggs. But neither spoke a word. Mr. Matthews was still in the kitchen and was also clinging onto every word that was being said. Mrs. Blythe returned a few moments later. She carried with her a small black box. It wasn't particularly tall when compared with the boxes that would have once carried the funnel hats that had been in trend recently. That the taller they were, the more prosperous the man beneath was. At least that's what the wearers told themselves. Here it is, Mrs. Blythe announced. He took the other box, the larger one, but this one he left for some reason. She opened the lid. Tanner looked to Steer. The details of the murder were well known to both the police and the public. And there contained within was a key piece of information. For in the lid was the details of the hat maker printed within the soft cloth used to protect the hat from damage whilst being transported or stowed for years. J. H. Walker of 49 Crawford Street was clearly visible, and Tanner felt even closer to the man who was sailing further away. He had a friend, you know, Mrs. Blythe suddenly added as Tanner was lost in contemplative stare into the box. Sorry, Tanner replied as he snapped to attention. He had a friend he would go and see. He doesn't live so far. He's only joined us for a meal once or twice. What's his name? Tanner pressed.
Hoffer, I think. A Mr. John Hoffer? Or was it Hoffer? Anyway, and I have that letter.
Letter? Tanner inquired, puzzled.
The letter.
Oh, did I not tell you about that?
I thought I did, mumbled Mrs. Blythe. He sent it from the Victoria.
Who did?
Mr. Muller, of course.
What is the Victoria?
The ship he's on, of course.
You have a letter and you know the name of the ship.
I do. I thought I told you.
Mrs. Blythe brought a letter from a drawer and handed it to the inspector. We need to find who runs the ship, Tanner spoke to Steer. Where it is going and when it will arrive in its destination and then get on top of it. Tanner left along with Steer and Matthews the house at 16 Park Terrace. Upon leaving, Matthews was dismissed and Steer was charged with taking the hatbox that Mrs. Blythe had found in that room that until recently Franz Muller had occupied within her home. The pieces of evidence suggesting that this German man, Franz Muller, was more than just a man of interest were stacking up. They now had a hatbox from the same maker that had formed the hat that was found in the carriage numbered 69. Which had been stained with the blood of the murdered Thomas Briggs. They also had information from Mrs. Blythe that Franz Muller was in possession of a chain that, although he said nothing of it, he had shown to them on the Monday, the same day in which a man with a foreign accent, possibly German, had been into the Brothers Death's jewelry shop on the Cheapside and exchanged a gold chain believed to belong to the murdered for a chain in gold of similar but not exact value. After a short journey, Tanner arrived at the home of Mr. John Hoffer, whom Mrs. Blythe had informed had been a friend of an acquaintance of her former lodger. It was now early in the summer evening, and Tanner knocked on the door of the London townhouse. A short while later, a man came to the door.
Tanner, Metropolitan Police. Mr. John Hoffer? The man nodded. We have some questions for you about Franz Muller.
Oh, he's on his way to America, I believe.
Yes, we are aware. We have some other questions to do with recent events.
John Hoffer welcomed Tanner in and led him into the home where they could talk further.
Inside the home, Tanner began his line of questioning.
What do you do, Mr. Hoffer?
I'm a journeyman, a tailor. I work at Messrs. Hodgkinson's, but I also do contracted work for Mr. Repsch. Tanner made a note of the name.
How long have you known Mr. Muller?
Not long, perhaps just 2 months.
Could you tell me the movements of Mr. Muller as you remember them around the weekend of the 9th of July?
Oh, I remember the 9th of July. I was at Mr. Repsch's and saw Franz between 6 and 7 in the evening. I came and found him there. I do not remember if he was at work or not. He left before me. He left between 7 and 8. He paused just for a moment.
Nearly at 8 o'clock, he said, now more sure of himself.
Did he say anything to you when he left? Tanner pushed.
He said he was going to see his sweetheart.
And do you know this sweetheart of his?
I've never met her, no.
I saw him again on the Monday at Mr. Repsch's. That was around 2 o'clock. Tanner made another note. 2 o'clock would have given Franz Muller plenty of time after the opening of the deaf shop and having done his trade to then to travel to many places within London.
I noticed he had a small chain on him that I had not seen before. Tanner underlined his previous notes.
He said he had bought it.
I don't know if he said where, I don't remember, but he did say he'd given £3.15 for it.
Which is a lot of money, I'm sure you'll agree,
Tanner nodded.
I left Mr. Repsch's and went to my work, then returned in the evening and Franz was still there. We left together and I went with him to his lodgings at Mrs. Blythe's.
I've met her, Tanner interjected.
I stayed there a while and then loaned him 12 shillings.
You loaned him money?
I did. It wasn't then, but a day after or so. Mr. Repsch said that Franz needed money to make it to America and he was 12 shillings short. I gave Mr. Repsch a suit of mine to pawn to raise the money needed. That was on the Wednesday. I presume that would be the 13th.
It would.
He left not long after. He made up his mind he was going to America a fortnight before. He also was lame. I knew he was.
On the Saturday, did he have 1 or 2 slippers on? Tanner asked.
One, I am certain. He'd been lame for a few days prior.
Do you know what caused the problem with his foot, Mr. Hoffer?
I don't know.
Very well. Thank you for your assistance, Mr. Hoffer.
Tanner left the home of Mr. Haffer and realized now was the time to act. There was a lot to get organized, for now he was certain that what had to be done. He had to give chase. He first had to make a visit to Bow, and in particular the magistrate, Mr. Henry, at the magistrate's court on Bow Street. The magistrate's was a magnificent building. Its front facade towered over the narrow and winding old Bow Street, but it was surrounded by Broad Court, Crown Court, and Martlet Court, and was only a stone's throw from the Covent Garden. Despite only being 100 years in age, Bow Street magistrates had seen more than its fair share of history. The first magistrate had been Colonel Sir Thomas Defile, notorious for the Gin Act of 1736 that established a tax on gin. But most importantly, he had helped to create the first professional police force, the Bow Street Runners, a collection of 8 constables established by the De Vale's successor, Henry Fielding. Fielding was in turn followed by his half-brother, Sir John Fielding, a blind magistrate and known as Blind Beak of Bow Street, who refined the patrol of 8 constables into the first truly effective police force in the capital, and eventually the Metropolitan Police found its headquarters at number 25 and 27 after its own establishment in 1829. It was a sight of history for Tanner as he rushed toward the court. If it were not for this building, he might not be employed in a profession he was proving to be more than adept at. Tanner had to stand before the magistrate, Mr. Henry, and present him with all that he had discovered since he had begun with the investigation over a week prior. For a week's work, it did not present much and was predominantly circumstantial. He had the hat box from Mrs. Blythe and the hat found in the carriage numbered 69. Otherwise, the case that he had so far built was based predominantly upon the chain that had been exchanged with the brother's death, and the jewellery box that Mr. Matthews had found within his home. For a short while, Mr. Henry debated within himself the evidence that Tanner had presented and the argument he had made. If it was true that this suspect, Franz Müller, was on his way to New York, it would not be an easy situation to extract him from a nation that was at war with itself. However, New York was not like the more southerly states. It was like London, a growing metropolis, and thus belonged within the modern industrial and wealthy world. New York had followed in the footsteps of London, having just 15 years after the creation of the London Metropolitan Police created its own modern police, using the Metropolitan Police and its military-esque structure as the framework all the way down to the later use of the blue uniforms. Therefore, there was a hope that their American brethren might be willing to lend a hand with the investigation and extradition that would have to be processed. "If you are to have Mr. Müller, the suspect of yours, Tanner," began Magistrate Henry, "extradited from American shores, then I think it would be best if you were to be able to prove beyond reasonable doubt that he is the man you are searching for." "Sir?" questioned Tanner. "You better take one of those brothers Deaf and Mr. Matthews with you, seeing as they are vital to the case. They, with your investigation, might be able to lend credence to your case."
"Take them where, sir?" inquired Tanner.
"To America, but of course."
To America. The case had become bigger than anyone could have imagined. Sure, before there had been joint cases between Britain and the continent, but to travel across the Atlantic to America, this, to Tanner, felt as if it was something great and new. There was little time to waste dwelling on the scale of the investigation that it had taken on, for he now had to travel to the New World quicker than Franz Müller. To be there standing on the dock in New York when the Victoria arrived would mean having to take a far faster boat for America. Tanner, with a sergeant clerk, made haste with the rounding up of Deaf and Matthews. The four then met at Euston Station in London and took advantage of the train travel to Liverpool, a journey that once would have taken a few days by cab, now was covered in the night. In Liverpool, one of the great gateways for emigration from the old world towards the new, the group arrived at Lime Street Station, a great neoclassical facade opening onto a wide plaza covered with the people of a city coming about to life on a new working day. It took little time for the four to find a cab, Mr. Matthews naturally being inquisitive to the habits of his counterpart cab drivers, and Tanner asked the driver to hurry to the docks. In Britain, there were 3 great lines for steamships. One was in Southampton, the Cunard Line. 2 were in Liverpool, the White Star Line, and the Liverpool, Philadelphia, and New York Steamship Company, commonly named after its founder, the Inman Line. It was with the latter that the four chose to sail, or rather to steam. The City of Manchester was a great ship, a steamer with auxiliary sails.
She had the silhouette not so different from a traditional ship, bar the singular funnel that rose from a deck and told the onlooker of the more modern technology that was nestled within her hull. Built in 1851 by Todd and McGregor in Glasgow, she had begun service a year later carrying steerage passengers. She provided service for French troops during the Crimean War in 1856 and gone to Calcutta a year later as a result of the Indian Mutiny that had led to the deaths of 6,000 British troops and 800,000 Indians due to the brutal suppression and starvation by the British occupiers. A year after this, the city of Manchester changed destination from Philadelphia to New York. So it was on the 20th that they sailed and were due to arrive in New York on the 5th, a full 20 days ahead of Franz Müller and the Victoria. But the news of the investigation travelled even quicker. There was naturally little momentum to print of the first murder on British rail in the papers of New York initially. They had far more important and local concerns to address first. But on the 26th of July, the first reports hit the New York Times. The news, however, was old. Inspector Kerasi was still listed as investigating, and there was no mention of a suspect. It was in fact only on the 4th of August, the day before the due arrival of the City of Manchester steamer in the port of New York, that the full details of the case, Mr. Matthews, Mr. Deff, Sergeant Clark, and Inspector Tanner, were published as they stood on the 19th of July. Then on the 7th, 2 days after the group's arrival in New York, the Times published this retrospective article from the 3rd.
On Tuesday night, we were able to publish the gratifying intelligence that the police were, this time beyond all doubt, on the track of the murder of Mr. Briggs. This Wednesday morning has brought full confirmation, and at this moment a steamer bound for New York and bearing on board of her the evidence to justify and the warrant to authorize the arrest of the murderer as soon as he sets foot on shore is dashing down St. George's Channel. The deep interest which the tragedy has excited is sustained by the facts which have come to light, and the story has gained in dramatic force by the proofs forthcoming. On the 9th of July, the savage deed was perpetrated. On the 19th, the fact was traced home to its author, and justice was at his heels. This is prompt and takes a load of apprehension off of every mind. The discoverer of the proofs shows that the assassin, like most criminals, was a man of no ability whatever. Intense stupidity marks all his acts subsequent to the murder. If that is any satisfaction to the public, the fact is plain enough. It may also be inferred that the murder was, in a certain sense, unpremeditated. That is, Mr. Müller did not dog the steps and plan the death of Mr. Briggs. It seemed that he once had a gold watch, and that in some, it is implied, discreditable broil, he lost his watch. From that time, a passionate desire to obtain a gold watch took possession of him. Hence, we may infer that he either found himself alone with Mr. Briggs by accident, or that seeing Mr. Briggs alone in a first-class carriage, he got in because he saw that Mr. Briggs possessed the coveted article. Thus, once on the track, a host of proofs have been found, and armed with these proofs, and with the due authority from the American Embassy, the police and the two chief witnesses, Matthews and Mr. Death, are on their way to anticipate Franz Müller on his arrival at New York. It is worthy of remark that the discovery made is not due to the skill of any detective. The evidence has come to light almost by accident. Certainly this terrible incident is a grave lesson to the predatory and homicidal class. It shows them how difficult is escape, and how the commission of crime dulls the brightest minds, and making the stupid more stupid turns their would-be cunning to their own destruction.
The article caused a sensation. In his passage from London to New York, Franz Müller was a loss to the information that both sides of the Atlantic were drawn into the criminal act of the murder of Mr. Briggs. That when, on the 25th of August, the Victoria sailed into New York, it wasn't just Tanner, Clark, Deff, Matthews, and the New York police waiting for him, but half of New York City itself. Join us next week for the continuation and the final part of Murder on the Tracks and how the case turns to involve the British Prime Minister and King Wilhelm of Prussia. Thank you for listening to Arctung History, written and presented by myself, Simon J. James, and produced by the Berlin Tour Guide. You can support Arctung History on patreon.com/ArctungHistory from as little as €1 a month and gain access to exclusive content. If you wish to keep up to date with this podcast, visit the website at theberlintourguide.com/ArctungHistory or follow on Twitter and Instagram at Arctung History. It's the sound of distant thunder on the plains, way under lightning crashes. It's the sound of howling wind and driving rain, and heaven's on fire.